You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Timothy Conway. Timothy is an author, mystic, and teacher of non-dual philosophy, also known as Advaita. He received his bachelor's degree in religious studies at UC Santa Cruz and his master's and doctorate at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He has been teaching classes on spirituality at Pacifica Graduate Institute, Antioch University, and Santa Barbara City College. He is best known for his outstanding book, Women of Power and Grace, Nine Astonishing Luminaries of Our Time. The deeds, miracles, and teachings of these nine women, considered to be saints, will be an inspiration to those who seek the deepest wisdom of spirituality. The book includes many of their teachings in their own words, with special emphasis on the women of India, who teach the sublime, non-dual Vedanta philosophy, one of the greatest philosophical achievements in the history of human thought. His website began in September of 2006 and has over 110 original essays, some short, some book-length, around 2,200 printed pages of total material, with several dozen photos and sacred images. You can see that, you can read them by going to his website at www.enlightened-spirituality.org. So, let's welcome Tim back to the show now. Hi, Tim, how are you?
Oh, very well. An amazing dream we're all privileged to be part of together in the great reality.
Yeah.
Dreams up and animates everyone and everything. Thanks for having me on your show, Lance.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak with you always. We talk about the dream, and we know that most people are probably pretty much asleep. Do you see this changing in the present or near future?
Well, actually, I view everyone deep down as quite awake.
Ah.
Everyone's true nature, the true self that's animating each of these cells, the superpersonal reality, the divine or the Buddha nature or the Tao, the one who is playing as each and every one, this is always awake. So I always trust that deep down everyone is this awakeness principle, that right where you are in your most sublime, fundamental, and original nature, you are absolutely whole, complete, spotless, unimprovable, and quite awake. It's just a semblance, a dream play, a lila, as they would call it in ancient India, and through the centuries, this term lila, like a divine play, a game of hide-and-seek, as a number of the mystics of India and the Far East and the West have referred to our situation, where somehow the suprapersonal reality, the divine, the one self, plays at being this personal self and feeling, well, the full gamut of emotions and sensations and perceptions and identifications. And the Buddha was the one in ancient history who investigated this most precisely and thoroughly, all the different aspects of personhood. And he basically told all listeners that, you know, all of this is just relatively true. It arises as a part of an amazing, complex play of causes and conditions, but your real nature is not this. You express as this and function as this, but your fundamental, truly individual, undivided, unborn, unconditioned, uncompounded, unmade nature, the Buddha nature, is not anything like being a human being or an animal or any kind of being that you could find yourself as in the rounds of rebirth and the great samsara play. It's a terrible play in terms of the pain and intensity and frustration and disappointments and losses. But it also has tremendous pleasures and thrills and excitements and beautiful moments of shared personhood in our deep relationships with each other. And so the Buddha and all the great sages are teaching you are freedom itself. You are the great reality, and there is this play going on as kind of a dream arising, kind of a superimposition. So we honor the arising relativity of the play and personhood and interpersonal relations, but we're not fooled. We know that deep down, everyone we contemplate, everyone we meet, when we check in and do, quote, self-inquiry, we find out that only the one is here, the reality doing everything and being everyone. And this is a spiritual reality, utterly formless, unborn, seamless, structureless, the very source of space, time, matter, energy, the whole play of phenomena. But your true nature intrinsically is not at all a phenomenon. It is prior to all. This is primordial awakeness, the infinite, the absolute. And this is who everyone is, truly. So I don't concern myself as to when all the persons are going to awaken to the superpersonal. I take it as the divine grace of this superpersonal nature that each and everyone fundamentally is, that it will awaken people in God's time. And then, you know, these awakenings, there can be a sudden, you know, blowout, life-changing kind of awakening. But more often for most people, it's a series of awakenings. The great Japanese Zen master Hakuin said, I forget the exact number, but he said something like he underwent like 32 major awakenings and hundreds of other awakenings. And Dogen Zenji, the founder of the Soto Zen tradition in Japan, said that enlightenment or awakening is actually an ongoing matter. You can't say you're awakened or enlightened and then kind of rest on your laurels.
Right, right.
So, but everyone can fundamentally awaken to a large extent just beyond the illusion of being a separate being, so that they don't take the personhood so seriously. They may still get caught and identified with different personal forms of reactivity, the so-called samskaras, to use an ancient Vedanta and Buddhist term that has a lot of significance and precision to describe these kind of binding and non-binding, unwholesome and somewhat more wholesome kinds of likes and dislikes and talents and gifts and foibles and hang-ups and so forth. It's everything that constitutes the patterns of personhood. Mm-hmm. And we can awaken to the more wholesome aspects of that kind of functioning is flowing, and then leave off and drop or outgrow the unwholesome conditioning. And so all of that is part of becoming a thoroughly transformed being. But in the Chan and Zen Buddhist traditions, they say one can awaken to one's primordial, unborn, fundamental, absolute nature, and then personhood can be evolved over time in a lighter and freer way, so that one's spirituality isn't this heavy ego project, but it's all, in a sense, being done by the one, just like everything's being done by this one reality. These people that boast of their own enlightenment, you know, how do they actually digest their food or wield language or move a hand or a limb? It all happens by this mysterious power that no one can say is mine, because it's too absolute. It's too supra-personal. So I say that most people can have profound personal awakenings, and that'll be part and parcel of a long cellular evolution where persons are having their unwholesome samskaras worked out, worked through, dropped, and replaced by wholesome personal tendencies, virtues, and talents, and gifts, and strengths.
What happens if that doesn't happen?
Oh, it happens. I see it as just par for the course that beings, and that's why a reincarnationist model makes sense. We're one of the few cultures, you know, Western, post so-called Enlightenment, European culture predominating in the United States and even in big universities in certain Asian, Middle Eastern places. The so-called Enlightenment thinking, the secular humanist Enlightenment and scientific revolution of a couple of centuries ago, that has brought in a view that questions anything that's not measurable, detectable with scientific equipment, or according with a kind of materialistic, reductionist worldview. And so that view poo-poos things like postmortem survival and things like phenomena like rebirth and so forth. But the data is out there. There's so much evidence. Children that remember past lives with, you know, vivid details, and various observers go and corroborate those details and this sort of thing. People have undergone various forms of regression therapy and can report back precise details that can be corroborated from past lives and so forth. So, and the Buddha himself said, anyone who denies rebirth and the law of karma and so forth is a heretic, a nihilist, preaching the heresy of nihilism. You can't just only teach the absolute truth. So on the conventional level for personhood, there is rebirth, and that gives many, many opportunities for people to work through their karmic stuff, namely these samskaras, the binding samskaras, the really heavy patterns of reactivity, so they can drop their guilt and shame, their anger, their hatred, their stubbornness, their jealousy and envy, and all these unwholesome states. The Buddha says it's very easy. Over time, just let more and more of the unwholesome states get replaced by wholesome states. And then he identified different levels, thresholds, if you will, of greater and greater freedom functioning for the personal consciousness. But all the while, throughout this whole cellular evolution for souls or persons, personal consciousnesses, your suprapersonal nature never moves, never changes, doesn't grow, cannot improve, because this is always speckless and spotless and pure, formless spirit. Open awareness.
That would include those who, let's say, were, just for argument's sake, who were in control of running the world, as one example,
sure,
and who use various things to gain control over assets and humans, and you do things that are basically evil.
Yes.
Are you saying then that they will also have to face their actions in the multiple lives, because it
seems certainly
they know.
Yeah, there's definitely karmuppance. We get our comeuppance through these karmas. You know, as the Jesus taught, Yeshua of Nazareth, as he was known, you know, as you sow, so shall ye reap. You know, whatever you plant, whatever kind of seeds you plant, that's what you're going to get. The Buddha, of course, 450, 500 years before Jesus, was obviously teaching this. There was even a teaching before the Buddha in the ancient Upanishads about karma and rebirth. And that's why we always pray, you know, for people in all walks of life, all stations in the universe, including the worst demons in the cosmos, the so-called asuras, or the titan or demon energy, which is very powerful, but very, very selfish, very evil, because it has zero empathy or sensitivity for other beings' feelings, and uses other beings as objects. And in our human realm, we see how some asura types, these demon consciousness types, can take human birth, and they can quickly, you know, when they're young, gravitate into positions of power and hook up with other very powerful people and wind up in positions of political leadership, high finance leadership, heading armies, the dictators and their death squad throughout Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of Asura energy, it very much manifests as what psychologists like Robert Almeter know as the authoritarian personality syndrome. And, of course, the current president of the United States has all of these qualities in spades.
Yeah.
So, you know, I pray daily for old DJT, Donald J. Trump, for instance, because I know his upbringing was all screwed up. He had to go around with his father. His father would take his little boy Donald along on these, you know, rent-collecting tours where he'd go into slumlord projects and have little Donald next to him as he demanded money from these poor tenants who couldn't come up with their last two rent checks. You know, what a formative experience that must have been
kidding.
For little Donald. And not to mention his father's racism that's been openly documented now in different sources. So a being like that, you know, probably came in with some troubled karma, and now he has a lot of personal power from that kind of Asura type consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's very sad. He actually suffers, it seems, from quite a number of mental, emotional disorders. My background is actually mainly in psychology. I not only got that BA in religious studies, but a BA in psychology from University of California, and then my graduate work was in special East-West psychology. So I've delved thoroughly into the sacred traditions, but I also am very keen on developments over the decades and generations in Western psychology. So, yeah, I can look at someone like Donald Trump, and, you know, the poor guy is suffering from a whole host of different disorders. So the man is suffering on a deep level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as are almost all jivas or persons, each of us wind up having certain Achilles heel, so to say, certain vulnerabilities, and we get tested on them. And his test just happened to be coming in a very public way. So, you know, we could point to all sorts of figures of history, extremely well-known, lesser-known, and then just look at, our neighbors, ourselves, our families, the people we know, and see all of these different kind of samskaras, wholesome and not so wholesome, on display.
Mm.
And it's a very poignant situation, the plight, if you will, the cosmic plight of persons who have forgotten their suprapersonal nature, and therefore they can't have faith in and rest in and relax or recede back, as my teacher Sri Nisargadatta would say, or invite, recede back into your absolute nature, you know, the suprapersonal nature beyond mere personhood.
Mm-hmm.
This is not impersonal, what we're receding into. But the suprapersonal, the source of all persons, yet this which transcends all persons. So at different points in a life or over lifetimes, recurrently, beings will get wake-up calls to trust in this vaster self, the reality doing everything and being everyone. And if they can allow just a certain amount of humility, you know, from that old root word, humus of the earth, if they can be willing to stop trying to be, you know, the one thinking they're in charge and the one with the power, if you can intuit radically that there's a great power, formless, shapeless, colorless, that's doing your entire life. It's breathing you. It's thinking thoughts. It's allowing you to comprehend and wield language and grow cells and renew cells and so forth. It knows how to birth a body, grow it, age it, and then die it off so that the personal consciousness can, on a subtle realm, have more time in the subtle realms and then maybe associate with another birth. either on Earth or some other part of the cosmos. There's a great power orchestrating all of this and doing all of this, and anyone in a moment of humility and periods of humility can simply be awake to this, to relax back and merge in and as this. And so even, you know, like in the case of the Buddha, there was a very terrible, evil man. He was a murderer who was one of those highwaymen who would hide out by the highway and then ambush people coming through and, you know, steal their wealth, kill them off so there'd be no witnesses. Mm-hmm. There's one evil son of a gun. And the Buddha encountered him one day on the road, and after just a short bit of exchange, sharing the Dharma, the great spiritual truth with this fellow, Angulimala was his name, the Buddha converted him to the way of the Buddha, and the man was so intense that he actually applied that intensity to self-inquiry and investigating phenomena in a spiritual way, and very quickly awoke to being a perfectly released being.
Wow.
And the Buddha celebrated him as being a true arhat, or someone who had undergone the complete sloughing off of all selfishness and the allowing of all the beautiful qualities of loving kindness, empathetic compassion, sympathetic joy, and a deep, deep peaceful equanimity. Those are the marks of an arhat, someone who's outgrown all forms of self-conceit, selfish greed, clinging. And so the Buddha said this can happen for anyone, and it could happen to the worst asura, demonic type personal consciousness, and it can certainly happen for anyone not suffering so intensely. So that's what allows one to be a tremendous optimist and an omni-optimist, seeing God, like Ramana Maharshi, the great sage of South India, who dropped the body, as we say, back in 1950. He was by far the greatest wisdom sage of non-duality of India in the first half of the 20th century, and his legacy certainly lives on. Ramana, I've said it before in many satsang talks over the years, the free gatherings and non-dual truth that I've been fortunate to be able to facilitate over the decades. Ramana, I've often said, was so beautiful and so gracious because he never saw anyone as not being awake, never saw them as not already being in their true nature, the self, open awareness, absolute isness. It's pure.
And that could entail hundreds or thousands of lifetimes in the future, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah. Ramana just saw that everyone, despite appearances and despite their own subjective personal sense of being stuck or caught or bound in some way, not free, frustrated or exasperated, maybe in despair, despite the subjective personal feelings, which are just feelings or, shall we say, self-concepts arising and passing, arising and passing, Ramana saw that underneath these arising and passing sensations, perceptions, emotions, and identifications, to use the Buddha's old schema, that everyone is innately free, innately pure, innately whole, utterly complete, and totally none other than the spirit itself, what in India they would call the Atman, or divine self, or the Brahman, the absolute divine reality. So, and that was what the Buddha taught all of his listeners, was, you know, let go of, that is, cease to identify with and indulge in all the arising sense of physicalities and then sensations based on that, perceptions based on sensations, and the emotional reactions based on the perceptions, and then the personal identifications based on all those emotions and perceptions and sensations and body sense. Cease to be identified with that. Realize this is not me. This is not who I am. This is not myself. That refrain, incidentally, is the most common found refrain in the Pali literature, the Pali language canonical literature of early Buddhism, and where the Buddha says, of all these arising phenomena that would seem to constitute personhood, this is not hey, this is not who I am. This is not myself. And that was what Ramana Maharshi and any great sage, male or female, ancient or contemporary, is teaching, the same principle of disidentification from all of this. It's awakening from the dream of phenomena, including the phenomenon of me, you know, the sense of me, myself, this person, the number one, all-important one. No, relax, recede back, transcend, step above. I mean, there's different metaphors. Pick your verb. Let it fall off, as Dogen Zenji said, you know, let body mind drop off.
Right.
What his Chan master in China had taught him. We know the Japanese very well, Shinjin Datsuraku. All the Soto Zen practitioners know that phrase. Let body mind drop off, or just be realized not to be your fundamental identity. And then what are you? Oh, you're this always floating free, unborn, unmade, uncompounded reality, a spiritual reality, the Buddha nature, or the Atman Brahman. I have a little kitty in the background crying, incidentally. Not out of sadness. She's just out of joy. She wants me to pet her right now. So she comes in and announces herself from time to time. So if you hear in the background a little high-pitched sound, that's her. So this is the great spiritual teaching of innate freedom, and that we are whole and complete in our true nature as we are, which means you need not be one of these neurotic seekers searching all over the place for what is always intrinsically what you are.
Right.
Like the Chan masters used to say, you know, the fingertip need not go in search of some place to touch itself. It need not try to touch itself. All it needs to do is realize fingerhood, and then it just functions beautifully as a finger. It touches other objects, but it does not need to try and touch itself. In the same way, our true nature, we don't need to try and make an object out of that. We're never going to find what we are as an object, a mere phenomenon, because who we are is the absolute. It's always prior to phenomena.
So
the so-called spiritual search can be dropped at the very start. Now, the Chan masters would teach sudden awakening to this absolute formless spiritual principle, your true nature, as is, right now, right here, closer than close. And right now, before you can even try and think about spirituality, what are you before thoughts? So this is sudden awakening to our intrinsic, unborn, formless nature, the absolute. And then the Chan master said, let there be a spontaneous, gradual cultivation. What Sri Nisargadatta, the wisdom sage of India, who dropped the body in 1981, his teacher, Siddha Rameshwar, said, you know, drop the seeker syndrome, but that then allows for a beautiful, wholesome aspiration on the level of the personal consciousness to allow itself to be utterly transformed by the superpersonal nature, the supreme divine reality. So, you know, there's a current version of non-duality going around, which is you are not a person, you don't really exist. There, you know, you thought there was a problem, you were seeking the seeker syndrome, that can stop right now. You are the self. Boom, that's it. Okay, now, just go along and just be that. Well, that's a truncated message. It doesn't allow for the total transformation of the personal consciousness by the power and grace of the suprapersonal nature. And that's why, you know, many people that actually had authentic connection with this non-dual tradition out of India or the Chan and Zen traditions and so forth, they realize that a lot of the current way in which non-duality is being taught is a very stunted form, and it winds up being very imbalanced. They teach very much about just realize the impersonal, and then they get everyone all kind of depersonalized, and there's no emphasis whatsoever on the actual second part of that Chan Buddhist formula of sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. They leave off altogether the cultivation part, which, again, through sudden awakening, it winds up being very spontaneous, and it doesn't have any of the stink of being a seeker any of that neurotic, syndrome.
Right.
That you find most people going around just desperate for some kind of experience or realization, and they, you know, there's all sorts of teachers and groups that have, created a real racket out of this, and
right.
They're promising you initiations into this level and that level, and whether it's Scientology to, I don't want to name names, but
well,
we all know that there's a lot of folks out there with their hand out, or their henchmen hold the hand out, and they drain people of their resources and demand. They're always going off on retreats and long programs and initiations and courses, and all of that's a racket.
Absolutely.
Because it, for one thing, obviates the possibility of immediate awakening, this sudden awakening that the Chan masters spoke of and the Buddha spoke about 2,500 years ago, and the Upanishadic sages spoke about 2,800 years ago, our most ancient wisdom text, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and Chandogya Upanishad, and a few others that arose even before the time of the Buddha. So a lot of the racket today, it denies the possibility of sudden awakening, and then the version of awakening it does teach is so stunted, it doesn't really allow for the beautiful, spontaneous, divinely graced form of personal transformation over this life and who knows how many lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this ongoing kind of enlightenment. And instead it sets up a racket of the enlightened guru and then maybe his enlightened disciple or a handful of disciples, and then they tend to lord it over others to keep the institutional racket going, and it all winds up being very non-egalitarian, and then you later find out that the so-called enlightened ones aren't behaving very enlightened, but of course they have a big rationalization about all that, and you're unenlightened for thinking that they're not enlightened just because they raped, seven of their young female disciples. That's your problem. It's not the enlightened guru's problem. So
they all seem to do it.
Well, not all. The true ones,
like
Ramana and the Buddha, they don't see people as mere objects, and therefore they don't feel the need to exploit people. Instead, they see people in their true nature as the absolute. They see the divine
everywhere. It seems that Mayor Baba talked about that, too. Was he around when you were in India?
I didn't get to India until I was 26 in 1980. I came into Burma first, Myanmar, as we call it now, and ordained as a Buddhist monk for a time. I had a rare opportunity to do that way up in northern Burma. They dropped the visa in my and handful of my buddies' situation. We went over with a Buddhist nun from Burma, so we had special access to be able to go way up into the boonies of northern Burma and apprentice to the senior most Theravada monk in all of Southeast Asia. And then from there I went on to India. I didn't stay in Burma. I could have stayed longer, but I wanted to go see Sri Nisargadatta, the great wisdom sage of Bombay, because I knew he had throat cancer and who knew how long he would be with the body. So I wanted to make sure I got there before he expired. So that was 1980. I was in Asia, and then through 81. I was there for a long time. And Meher Baba had already dropped the body in 1969. He was actually the first Eastern spiritual master I ever heard about when I had this very profound, life-changing spiritual opening in my 17th year back in 1971. I met a girl, a young woman, who actually, she was just a teenager, so was I. She had gotten into Meher Baba, and she shared a little about him. But it was really Ramana Maharshi who kind of won my heart.
Uh-huh.
It is very pure, simple, straightforward, non-dual teachings. But later, as karmas, good karma, sukarma, would work, I married a woman who was a Meher Baba devotee.
Oh.
And so I actually, on our honeymoon in 95, 96, in winter of fall winter of 95-96, we got over to India and spent some quality time at the Meher Baba Pilgrim Center, and I spent a lot of time up by his tomb shrine. Yeah, his teachings are quite beautiful, actually. The discourses would be there's a book called God's speaks, which is probably too metaphysical for most readers, I would say, and could probably confuse them. But if you just read like the Discourses collection and works like The Everything and the Nothing.
Oh, that's a wonderful book.
Yeah, you know, I actually have a long, long like book length web page at my website all about Meher Baba.
Oh, nice.
And it's got a huge collection of his teachings, ranging chronologically from when he first started sharing teachings as a very young man in the period before he actually took his decades-long vow of silence. But, you know, even when he took the vow of silence, he was still communicating, and that's where we get so many of his so-called talks and writings. It was his communications when he had adopted physical
silence.
He has
such a way of visualizing with through drawings the simplicity, the complexity of the simplicity of all that is.
Yes.
As it's just utterly amazing. I remember one of those had to do with the real everything was a circle, and then there was a small, the real nothing within it, and it's something to the effect that it's a shadow that always exists, and then from the real nothing is projected the, you know, non-real everything. And
right, the play of phenomena, the transient,
yes,
arising,
infinite
vanishing
nothing.
Play of phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, Meher Baba's teaching was beautiful because it was infused with two major streams of spirituality. On the one side, the Sufi spirituality that his Zoroastrian or Parsi father had explored in Iran and then in parts of northwest India when he traveled from Iran, you know, the Persian culture over to India, where in India the Persians are called Parsis, and they, especially the ones that are Zoroastrians, in terms of their ancestral religion. So on Meher Baba's father's side, he had this father who was a Parsi, a Zoroastrian from Persia, who had widely met with a lot of Sufi teachers in Persia and northwest India and what is today Pakistan, you know, since 1947 known as Pakistan. And then he met that Sufi woman that kissed him on the forehead when he was a teen coming home from school, and that's what really, in this shattering way, opened him up to his formless divine nature. So much so that, you know, he was entranced for like the next 9 months. He says he didn't drink anything, eat anything, or sleep. And then he went and met people like Sai Baba Shirdi and Sai Baba's disciple Upasani Baba, who worked with Baba to kind of help him have an experience again of the body and the earth plane. It's quite a phenomenal story. But Baba's teachings thereafter were infused by this Sufi sensibility, but from Upasani Baba Maharaj, he had a very strong Hindu Advaita Vedanta teaching. So with Baba, you get this beautiful fusion. You'll sometimes see, just in the same paragraph, he'll be using Sufi language and Advaita Vedanta language in the same breath almost. And so it allows for a lot of beautiful cross-fertilization and unique new ways of speaking about non-dual spirituality.
Mm. Well, I used to study the works of Gurdjieff, G.I. Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and as I understand it, Gurdjieff got much of his teachings from a monastery that was hidden away in the recesses of, I think it was Tibet.
I believe he was more interested in some of the teachings coming out of like the Naqshbandi Sufi traditions of Central Asia and that Caucasus region of, you know, southwest former Soviet Union. He's an interesting figure. There's been some good scholarly work on him in the last 10 or 15 years, as I recall. Gurdjieff's approach is very different, though, than like the Advaita traditions, because it's almost more like a yogic approach, because it's all about this work and doing all this unconditioning and reconditioning.
And that we're not complete as we are and have to finish ourselves.
Right, right. So it doesn't have the absolute truth level teaching context for helping people fundamentally, a priori, you know, at the start, at the outset, come from a place of freedom.
Right, right.
And so there's a very heavy, serious, you know, edge to a lot of that.
Yes.
That's the critique I find, for instance, for like Rajneesh, or renamed Osho.
Oh, yeah,
because he was very influenced by Gurdjieff and thought that, you know, so much of spirituality, and he presumed to be the one doing it, was about testing everyone.
Right.
You know, testing this person, testing that person. Well, much of it looks just like abuse.
Right.
And there's no teaching that speaks to a person's wholeness and completeness.
Right.
And that's why someone like a Ramana Maharshi, I believe, is just head and shoulders way far above a Gurdjieff or a Rajneesh, because he fundamentally looks at you and sees you as the absolute in your true nature. He sees you as wholeness and completeness.
Was that
then the context in which the awakening of the personal consciousness can occur, and the transformation of the personal consciousness over time, that is the outgrowing and smoothing out of you know, all the unwholesome conditioning, the binding samskaras, and allowing the wholesome samskaras, like certain strengths and gifts and skills and, you know, capacities for art or healing or, you know, running a school village or something. I mean, a village school. All of that can then function and flourish out of our intrinsic wholeness. So, yeah, we have to be careful with spirituality, because if the first step or the first teaching or the first insight is slightly amiss, then, well, whole lifetimes can be spent wandering around in confusion and struggle and that seeker syndrome, and it gets very painful, very alienated, and quite frustrating. People, you know, I get letters, emails, phone calls from people all over the world that have seen my website over the last nearly dozen years, and there are people that were taking courses and free satsang classes over the couple of decades before that, and, you know, they still have this idea that I'm not there yet, and, oh, this is wrong with me, and that's wrong with me, and I realize, you know, they'll name off, they'll rattle off names of teachers that are making the rounds and making millions of dollars and lots of books and videos and you name it. And these people come to me and they've been following these other teachers, but no one ever told them the real basics of true Advaita wisdom and showed them how to realize sudden awakening as soon as possible, so they didn't have to keep wandering around in this dream feeling alienated, limited, stuck, flawed. And unfortunately, teachers like Gurdjieff and Rajneesh only reinforce a lot of that.
Right.
Unless you join their system and subject to their tests, and who knows when you're ever going to be allowed to graduate out of the process.
Right.
So I find a lot of that very disempowering. The true sagely teaching is addressed to your intrinsic sageliness and is going to wake you up sooner than later.
Well, yeah.
Preferably right at the outset, so that the spiritual transformation occurs much more at ease, in a flowing,
now, one of the women that you mentioned in your book, Women of Power and Grace, is still alive, and she seems to be have gained a tremendous popularity, and that would be Amma, the Divine Mother.
The Hugging Mother.
Yes, the Hugging Mother. How would you categorize her way of being with people?
Well, her teaching actually, for the most part, is a more conventional kind of what we would call Dvaita or dualistic kind of teaching, although, you know, her teachings that have been compiled in the books over the years and in certain talks that may never have yet appeared in print, her teaching is grounded in a non-duality context. In that book, I specifically quoted her in a number of ways in that non-dual mode. But for the most part, she more conventionally teaches the kind of dualistic sense of, you know, you are a person, you must adopt these spiritual practices to realize the divine person nature, the supreme divine absolute. And a lot of people will then more conventionally have a sense of being a separate, distinct person who's working out their spiritual unfolding under the guidance and loving care and inspiration of Amma, the Hugging Mother. She's an incredible inspiration in her own life, the way she's just always been out there available to people since, you know, she really came public in the late 1970s in her local village. Hundreds of people from other villages and towns were coming to see her, and then thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands long before she made her first visit to the West. I was fortunate to be one of the handful of people in the U.S. that learned about her about 9 or 10 months before her first visit in 1987. I had heard about her in 1986 along with some friends. And there was a contingent. I was up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there was a contingent of people down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, because her number one Western male disciple, Neil Rosner, his brother lived in Santa Fe and was telling all these people about Amma. And then that fellow, Earl Rosner, moved to San Francisco, where myself and a handful of people had learned about Amma, and he was showing us videos. So we were fortunate. My friends actually helped set up her first world tour.
Wow.
Specifically the U.S. and European sections of the tour after she came out of Asia. So she is an inspiration, just sitting there, you know, for 12 hours or 18 or 26 hours without leaving, just hugging people one by one by one, you know, the unwashed, the rich and the poor, the happy, the disconsolately grieving. They would all come to her one by one, and she was just available to them ongoing. That's a kind of a non-duality in relationship and practice, the way she was
just
always
available.
Well,
say, Timothy, I have a quick question for you before we are at the end of the show.
Yeah.
If you were to say something to the listeners tonight that would give them an experience of who they truly are in, say, a minute or so,
yes,
what would you say to really cut to the core?
Well, let's see if we can get three things real fast.
Okay.
Number one, what are you? Closer than close, prior to the arising of a body-mind-me sense, what are you as this naked, open, raw isness, aliveness, awareness? You are this open capacity for experience. What you are is not an experience. Don't try to find God or the self as an experience. You are the very open awareness capacity for experience. Let there be a profound spiritual, not psychic, but spiritual intuition, a wise knowing by being that you are this absolute open spiritual being. And number two, you could do things like, as our most ancient wisdom text, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, said, you know, when you see something or anything, shapes, colors, lights, forms, what is the unseen seer of seeing? All visual objects are pointing back at you, the invisible, the host for seeing. In the same way, all sounds or physical silence, if you're out in the high desert somewhere, all sounds or physical silence point back to you, the unheard hearer of hearing. In the same way, any arising thoughts are all pointing back to you, the host for thinking, the non-perceptible host for all perceptions. And so you could also do things like close your eyes. You'll look at the back of your eyelids, and you'll just see dark with little flecks of color as little nerve impulses fire on and off, on and off. But what is this which is seeing the darkness?
Well, Tim, we have to end the show, unfortunately.
Yes.
We're running over now.
Any of those methods, I would just say, would point you right back to your absolute nature right now.
There you go. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming back, and I'm sure we'll be talking again one of these days soon, and I appreciate your sharing your wisdom and information with us tonight.
Thank you, Lance. It's a joy to hear your voice, your questions, and be available for you.
Very good. Well, good night, everybody.